are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 26, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan on the progressives' quest for congressional committee power. Power. Also on the program today, 13 agencies of the Trump administration releases a report saying that climate change is dire and the administration vows to do nothing about it. Meanwhile, the U.S. Border Patrol tear gases families to keep us safe. Standoff intensifies between Russia and Ukraine. Yemen peace talks set for December. Whatevs. Meanwhile, Trump far outpaced Obama in his two-year drone campaign. And tomorrow, Mississippi will possibly elect an unrequited racist to the Senate. Simultaneously, the Senate will confirm an unrequited racist to the federal judiciary. Data shows, meanwhile, right-wing violence rising in the United States. And coincidentally, in a bid to regain old friends, Gavin McInnes quits the Proud Boys, pretends to do it for the Proud Boys. And what are the Proud Boys? They barely exist anyways. Meanwhile, how Trump protects Iranian-enabled terrorism, and a government shutdown looms as Dems look to protect the Mueller investigation. Lastly, Trump's recession watch. GM announces 15,000 layoffs. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving. We are all back and rested. Well, we're not all back, but we're almost all back. Jamie is still stuck at the border, I think. I don't know. It's possible.
She's nowhere near Tijuana, is she?
Not. I don't know. I do not know. It's possible. I trust everyone had a good Thanksgiving. Matt, I heard that you got into an argument.
No, I was. I was more just holding forth and didn't really realize it until I was told about it the next day that I was a bit loudly talking about Disney and copyright in front of my friend's parents.
So. Right. Were they in any way associated with Disney or was
no,
it just
they were sort of just innocent bystanders, but they seemed a bit.
Who were you talking to about
just
this?
To everyone in the room.
I love Matt's version of a drunken rant. Like when he's like at the holidays, he's sipped a little too much and it's like a very genteel. It's like, yo, we really got to deal with the way Disney's just locking down our creative culture.
I mean, I probably am guilty.
It's like enlightened Steve Bannon. I love it.
I'm probably guilty of similar type of moments, but I'm just curious as to how one gets there.
I think it was because we were talking about Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is the guy, I forget what his name is, but he's very active on Twitter.
I can't remember now.
But he said it. We were talking about that, and then I mentioned his tweet about how Disney gave us copyright fascism and Mickey Mouse isn't funny. And just kind of use that as a launching off point.
Good. And Michael, did you have any sort of completely non sequitur style arguments with your Thanksgiving?
I did not, actually. It was pretty mellow, to be honest.
All right.
There's a fair amount of political agreement around the table.
There you
so
go.
The fights that we have, I won't report on in public.
Oh, I see. Okay. And Brendan, anything untoward happen at your Thanksgiving?
Very normal Thanksgiving at the Finn household, I gotta say.
All right, well,
good. Dad, thank you for the meal. It's delicious. You're welcome, son. How's the city going? It's going well, Dad.
Fred did really brings the Gentile energy.
My son has entered into a stage where he just says he hates me constantly. Now,
how old is he?
He's five.
That's an early adapter.
Well, he's just joking. However, when his sister, who's 13, constantly says it, she's not. She's serious. She genuinely hates me. He just thinks it's funny to say that he hates me. And then I say, all right, Saul, I'm enough. I've had enough of the joke. I'm not feeling so great about this. And he goes, can I keep calling you butt?
And do you let him or do you cuck out of it?
Yeah, no, I say butt's okay. I get that. That's a term of endearment. He's like, okay, butt.
He's a funny kid.
Yeah, he actually has a sense of humor. If he's funnier than Gavin McGinnis, but we'll get to that later. Meanwhile, while we were all enjoying our families, there were families at the border, several hundreds of people. I don't know what the percentage of families were. Some were families. Some were just children of parents, or some were just parents of children. And they have traveled through Mexico. They were at the border attempting to cross. And then, of course, you needed to disperse them to protect this country. You understand, these people, some of them had rocks. Some of them may be trained in martial arts. We don't know. And so we need to protect ourselves. And, of course, what did the Border Patrol do? Well, they fired high-density pepper spray and tear gas, according to the AP. There were some who, this according from the AP, U.S. border agents fired tear gas on hundreds of migrants protesting near the border with Mexico after some of them attempted to get through the fencing and wire separating the two countries. American authorities shut down the nation's busiest border crossing from the city where thousands were waiting to apply for asylum. Mexican police had kept the migrants from walking over a bridge leading to the Mexican port of entry, but migrants pushed past officers to walk across the Tijuana River below the bridge. Migrants walked along the river to an area where only earthen levee and concertina wire separated them from U.S. Border Patrol agents. And an AP reporter saw a U.S. agent shoot several rounds of tear gas after some migrants attempted to penetrate along several points along the border. And here is some guy on Fox and Friends. This is Ron Colburn. Colburn is from the Border Patrol Foundation. He's the president of the foundation that supports the Border Patrol. I'm not sure what they do.
Is that a tax-deductible organization?
I would imagine. Everybody's got to work, folks. And here he is going on Fox and Friends to explain all we did with the little kids is put a little pepper in their eyes.
There was a small hole they were able to puncture through the border wall, and they hurled all sorts of rocks, etc., at the Border Patrol agents, and then they fired the tear gas. Is that warranted?
Absolutely. And to clarify, the type of deterrent being used is OC pepper spray. It's literally water, pepper, with a small amount of alcohol for evaporation purposes. It's natural. You could actually put it on your nachos and eat it. So it's a good way of deterring people without long-term harm.
Oh, so those Mexican and Honduran and Guatemalan people could put it on their nachos.
They should be saying gracias.
Yes. Gracias.
That's what I say. Gracias.
Unbelievable. Couldn't miss the opportunity.
Couldn't miss out. Can I just interject something briefly here? It just occurred to me. I know we don't really debate the use of the word fascism on this show that much, but I think we're all basically on the same page. But it's like a manufactured fake crisis, which is the caravan, and then the actual barbarism of this is, I mean, you're starting to get extremely textbook now.
Very textbook. Very textbook. Here's some photos of some of those lucky migrants who are able to get some of that pepper spray and, I guess, theoretically put it on their nachos. As you can see, the kids are in diapers, and that's the most dangerous type of child, I can tell you that. And there's the mom wearing the frozen T-shirt, which is also, you know, obviously incredibly dangerous to the American people. And I think actually in the background, there you go. You can actually see a stroller back there across the ravine there.
Crisis child actors.
Yes, of course. And thank God we're being protected from these folks. Listen, we don't need more children running around in strollers, I can tell you that. Coming from Stroller Central in Brooklyn, I'm very, very glad that we are firing pepper spray at parents and their children so that they can't make their way up here and endanger all of us.
You've advocated that in front of Q train stops.
Oh, yes. Right? Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, here's Thomas Homan. He is the former acting director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And I think he's now executive director now of ICE?
He stepped down, but there's speculation that he will take over for Nielsen when she's puts in her act.
So, of course, he's going back on Fox New News.
Strength.
Yes. And here he is, saying that that these asylum seekers, this is all just a game for these people.
There's heartache when you see those pictures. There's the rule of law the president continues to hammer down on. How do you address both?
Incidentally, the rule of law would also have Jared Kushner and others in prison right now for their disclosure forms. The rule of law, not so rigid when you get to that point.
Yeah, going back to our discussion on fascism, when rule of law is invoked, maybe start to wonder, does this look like fascism opportunistically using the law?
I mean, it's a shame that those people had to have children to make it so dramatic when they were getting pepper sprayed. Here we go.
Well, first of all, I've said many times, I certainly feel bad for the plight of these people. But they're not asylum. They're not true asylum seekers. They don't qualify under existing law to claim asylum because they want to come here. You've seen them.
Pause it. You know, a funny thing about existing law, and, you know, you keep bringing up fascism. I'm not going to say what country it was and when, but what they managed to do was all legal because they changed the laws to make it legal to oppress certain minorities in their country. Now, you'll recall that Jeff Sessions changed, not so much the law, the regulations, I guess you could call it, but more or less the same, on what constituted a legitimate ask for asylum. We simply changed it. We simply basically banned all the reasons why you could seek asylum if you were coming from Central America. Domestic abuse, gang violence, the fact that your country was almost non-functioning in terms of dealing with crime and violence, that your child or your husband was murdered by a gang and you were under threat and there was no recourse in your own country. We just simply said it's no longer a legit reason for asylum. But let's listen to the game that's being played.
Asylum because they want to come here. You've seen them, they're carrying signs. I want a job. That doesn't qualify for asylum, so I certainly understand the plight of these people. I can certainly understand them want to be a part of this country, but there's a legal way to do it, and they're not following the legal process. They're using asylum.
They are using the exact legal process, which is you go up to the border, you say, I am seeking asylum, and then we have a legal process to determine whether or not your claim warrants asylum. That is the only legal process to get asylum for these people. Are they all have legitimate claims? Statistically, no. But we don't know which ones do. And that's why you have a legal process that is edified in U.S. law to make that determination. Theoretically, this guy knows it.
They're using the asylum system, which harms real true asylum seekers that really are escaping fear and persecution. But on your first point about the women and children escaping tear gas, we got to look at the facts here. A minority of this caravan, a small minority, is actually family members, women and children. Most of them are adult males. But the media, some of the media out there, are getting shots of the women and children to try to pull the heartstrings of America. And, you know, and even the caravan itself, the people that are coordinating this whole event, they'll put the women and children up front to make it seem like this is 5,000 women and children when it's not. They're playing the game. Some of the media outlets are playing the game. This is a vast majority of males seeking employment in the United States, not women and children.
Now, of course, males don't have families. We know this. Right? They're not family members. They're just males. They're just males looking for work, looking for probably very, very fancy and exotic jobs.
I'd actually suggest that it's some pretty anti-male chauvinism right there.
Not to raise money for their families, because of course they're males and couldn't possibly have families.
No, I have no family. I'm here to start a Patreon.
Right, exactly.
I want to become a YouTuber and abandon my family. Yeah. So that'll be asylum, please.
What does Homan have against males?
Yeah, what does he have against men? It sounds like it's a war on men from Fox News headquarters.
This is apropos. 2018 has been difficult for human rights, a difficult year for human rights. But if you ever wonder how rights and abuses are documented around the world, you probably have, with the sheer volume of global crisis we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders. It's critical we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They're an independent nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government. They rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. I should tell you, for what it's worth, that Human Rights Watch is going to be one of those charities that I let the kids pick a couple out of a list. One night during Hanukkah, don't get presents. You get to decide where your present money is going to go. And that's going to be one of them. I'll talk about the other ones maybe later in the week as we prep for Hanukkah. Also, this also makes a great gift. Saul and I were literally arguing about this morning when he crawled into bed. There is no need to suffer through another sleepless night. Calm and Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that helps you relax so you can fall asleep and stay asleep naturally. It's designed with high-density comfort fill to provide exactly the right amount of weight to help relax your body. It mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged and helps the production of serotonin and melatonin. I'm laughing because Saul literally is like, oh, can I have that blanket? Or just put it, it's so cozy.
Come on, bud. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Weighs 15 pounds. And he's like, I like it. And I'm like, what do you like about it? I can't move. He can't move. So you can sleep better, feel great, stress less. Plus, made with super soft velveteen material, Calming Comfort is 100% machine washable and dryer safe. It's like, I don't know what they call it velveteen, but it's that cuddly material for blankets. The material itself is not heavy. There are squares in it that are full of a heavy fill. It's very, I would not have thought, I mean, I guess I would have thought about it. I've layered, a bunch of heavy blankets on. That's the way I like to sleep, cold with a bunch of heavy blankets on. This does it for you. The Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY. And because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep, go online now, calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY for your special discount. And lastly, today's support for today's show comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients you can use to cook incredible restaurant-quality meals in as little as 20 minutes right to your door. Just choose from a variety of step-by-step chef-designed recipe options, all with insanely delicious flavors. Then get rid of your grocery list. Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary experience, Blue Apron has you covered. Folks, I've been talking about Blue Apron for a couple of years now. We were customers before. It's a total coincidence that they started to I should have made it not a coincidence, but it was a total coincidence they started advertising on this show. I've talked about some of my favorite meals. Immediately, I think of Blue Apron. I don't even know what it's called. It's like a, it's not a Mapo tofu, but some type of like round Asian, almost like a pasta, and pork. Oh God, now I can't even stop. But they now have like quicker to prepare meals, which are super helpful for me, being a single dad 50% of the time. So check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free. I don't know why anybody wouldn't do this. You get your first three meals free. Check it out. You're going to love the food. You're going to love the fact that you're going to be able to cook a home-cooked meal without having to worry about shopping for it, coming up with the recipes. It's perfect. BlueApron.com/majority. That's BlueApron.com/majority. Get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, quick break. When we come back, David Dan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program a reporter for, well, he reports for The Intercept. He writes for every major magazine that you've ever written. I mean, read, I would say. Also author of Chain of Title, perhaps the, I don't want to say the seminal, but one of the seminal books on the 2008 financial crisis that started with housing. And my understanding is he's writing another book. I can't remember off the top of my head what it's about, but David Dayan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you.
I hope your Thanksgiving was good.
It was just fine.
Okay. All just right. Fine. I'm glad to hear that. always happy.
How was yours, Sam?
Oh, you don't even want me to go into it.
Okay.
No, it was good. It was good. Mine was fine.
Okay.
But so I'm glad we got that over with. That could have been uncomfortable.
It could have been. It's not.
David, let's get into this. I read it. I read this piece last week. I wanted you on last week, and then I was like, I don't want it to get buried in Thanksgiving hoo-ha.
Right.
You wrote this piece in The Intercept. I find it fascinating because So much of politics is reduced to who are we going to elect to office. And there are two other major elements. One, from the perspective of citizens, we should be doing activism to get our elected representatives to do what we want them to do, in addition to building communities, et cetera, et cetera. The other is, what are these electives doing on the inside? Because so much of what happens in our government, and it makes sense, right, that it's going to be complicated and somewhat opaque from your average viewer, reader, listener, because we have a huge country. And it is, you know, it's like riding a bull in some respects. So you wrote about one of the power plays by the Congressional Progressive Caucus in the run up to the leadership challenge on Nancy Pelosi, which is still ongoing. But all right, tell us, just set the table for us. How big is the Congressional Progressive Caucus before the election, mm-hmm. after the election?
Before the election, I believe there are 77 members of the Progressive Caucus, and they actually picked up two shortly after the election, current members who decided to join. After the election, I mean, this was kind of an interesting question, because I think the membership is going to be more based, it's going to mean something a little more in this incoming Congress than it may have in past Congresses. I mean, you literally have a handful of members who are members of the Progressive Caucus and the New Democrats, which are the centrist sort of rival to the Progressive Caucus. So the Progressive Caucus in the last decade has been sort of more a badge you can wear. It's, hey, I'm progressive. I'm a member of the Progressive Caucus. Don't bother me. Now it's going to mean something a little more directly, I feel, and in my discussions with, you know, people in the know about this. It's going to mean that your votes are going to have to be a certain way. It's going to mean that you're going to have to, you know, provide a little more support for certain positions. So they think when that all shakes out, even though there are about 20 incoming members that are likely to join, there are probably going to be some drop-offs from members who want to sort of say they're progressive but don't want to really be voting in a manner consistent with the Progressive Caucus. So,
all right. Well, how does that? What's the mechanism?
What's
that mechanism? So Mark Pocan, right. Pramila Jayapal, others in the leadership.
What's the mechanism for enforcing that? I mean, I think it's the same as the mechanism for enforcing sort of the Freedom Caucus. You know, I mean, you vote our way, or we don't support you in your election. You know, and considering that a Progressive Caucus member, Mike Capuano, lost his election to an up-and-coming member, Ayanna Pressley, and others seemingly would be on the radar in this next Congress, I think that's a somewhat credible threat. So, you know, there's going to be a bit of a shakeout, but bottom line is about 40% of the caucus is Progressive Caucus. 40% of House Democrats are going to be in the Progressive Caucus in the new congressional term.
Okay, so 40%, that's a pretty big, if they are voting,
it's a big number.
It's a big number, and it's an important number if they're voting as a block, right? I mean, if they are... And presumably, right, they're coming up with at least, maybe they don't write it down, or maybe they do, but with basically a scoring mechanism. These votes that you need, we need you to take these votes. If you don't take these votes, we give you a C- or a D or an F. And if we give you an F, we're going to be out there, or even a D, we're going to be out there, and we're going to be supporting a progressive challenger to you in your district. And so... that makes a big difference if you're voting like a block, right? It doesn't even matter. I mean, your size is less relevant. I mean, the Freedom Caucus,
Freedom Caucus is 30 people.
Yeah. I mean, so we're talking
Freedom Caucus. We're talking about a third of what the Progressive Caucus is likely to look like. And now it's not going to be quite as cohesive as the Freedom Caucus. I think that's pretty clear. But even if it's minimally cohesive, given the margins in the Democratic in the House next year, you don't need that many to swing votes.
Right. Okay. So Progressive Caucus is anew. And so what did they, what was their first sort of like, I don't know if it was their first, but it feels like it was their first real exercise of this, I don't want to say authority, but this power.
Yeah, this was a definite power play. So, you know, we have this leadership sort of battle, with Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi needs not only a majority of Democrats in the House to vote for her this week, to be their nominee for speaker. But on the floor, because of the way it's structured, she needs a majority of all members in order to get the speaker nod, which means she needs virtually every Democrat to vote for her on the floor in order to become speaker. And that gives members some power to dictate terms. And the Progressive Caucus knew this, sought this, had a meeting with Pelosi where they said, hey, look, we're 40% of this caucus. However, we don't get 40% of the seats, particularly on key committees. And four of them are domestic, and then one of them is separate, and we'll talk about them separately. But the four domestic policy committees through which virtually all domestic legislation runs, we're talking about the Appropriations Committee, which sets the funding and appropriates money. We're talking about the Ways and Means Committee, which is mainly tax policy and trade. We're talking about the Energy and Commerce Committee, where healthcare legislation and climate legislation would go through. And we're talking about the Financial Services Committee, which is financial regulation and housing policy and all sorts of other things. So those four committees, and then separately the Intelligence Committee, which only has one Progressive Caucus member out of its nine, the other four are all under that 40% marker. And the Progressive Caucus said, we want 40% representation. We want proportional representation on all of these committees. And Pelosi said, yes, you can get that. We will restructure so that you get that committee proportional representation. And that's a very big deal because these are the places where this legislation will initiate. When you're thinking about almost everything that progressives are moving to want, whether it's legislation on prescription drugs, legislation on single-payer health care or Medicare buy-in, legislation on a Green New Deal. You name it. It's all going to go through these committees. So don't have the people, you're not going to get your stuff through.
All right. Explain that dynamic, because I'm not sure that folks understand. I mean, more or less people know, you know, you have a bill and then it becomes a law. And then it gets signed by the president.
I need to do a little Schoolhouse Rock here.
Please, you don't have to say, but
the committee structure is very important in that. There are committees of jurisdiction. I mean, look, much of Congress is turf wars, right? If you have legislation on health care, the committee in the House, there are actually two, the Energy and Commerce and the Ways and Means Committee, they're going to say, well, we're taking that bill. We get that bill and we decide whether to mark it up. We decide what to do with this bill. Anybody can introduce a bill, but it goes into one of those committees. And if it has to do with taxes, if there's any kind of financing for it, Ways and Means is going to look at it. If it has to do with all sorts of issues, whether it's healthcare or climate or whatever, Energy and Commerce is going to look at it. And they, that's where the baseline bill begins. I mean, you know, things can be done on the floor of the House, although we don't see that very much anymore. But the committees really control the legislation. And where they begin is critical to where they end. They begin is in those committees.
And this is where the bills get formed. I mean, you have a you can introduce a bill, but it goes through essentially, you know, a sausage factory, as it were.
The factory is, and there aren't enough progressives in those factories. And so this was the power play to get the proportional amount of progressive caucus members in those committees doing the work to shape that legislation. We've learned from history here. In after 2008, when we had the Dodd-Frank legislation, turned out that a lot of these freshmen and sophomore congressmen who won in 2006 and 2008, who were blue dogs and new Democrats, they flocked to the Financial Services Committee. And they got to shape that legislation, which was actually far worse in the House than it ended up being in the Senate, which is the opposite of what you would think. Because the Senate is, you know, people who, senators come from states, supposed to be more moderate. Actually, they were better on that bill because the committee was stacked with new Dems and blue dogs who go there because it's a source of funds. The lobbyists control are interested, let's say, in all of these money committees, and they will spend money to influence them. And it was commonplace for Democrats to put these new Dems that they call the frontline members who need to raise a lot of money to retain their seats on these committees for access to those lobbyist donations. So we know that that affected Dodd-Frank. We know that made Dodd-Frank worse. And progressives didn't want to see that happen again. So this is not just for now, right? Because you get seniority, you move up through the committees, the more longer that you've been on one, the more opportunity you have to influence legislation. This is not just for now. This is for far into the future. When we have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, to have progressives in these positions will change the face of the legislation that ultimately comes out.
And people should understand this dynamic. It works. I mean, the idea that these new Dem types, right, would flock to these committees that control the money, and then moneyed interests will bankroll their reelection campaigns and presumably in some instances spend against any opponents and whatnot. There's also a flip side to this in that, like, these committees are not that sexy from a progressive standpoint in attracting
right.
the same money, because, you know, the whole point is that Wells Fargo is not going to see, let's just use her as an example, AOC on the Financial Services Committee and go like, oh, this is going to be some, we're going to shower her with cash, right? This is not,
right.
not going to happen. Meanwhile, you know, I guess the Greenpeace, I don't know how big their lobby is. There's something.
right.
But the Greenpeace, you know, to the extent that they can get their members to vote for somebody, is not going to vote for somebody who's on the financial services. They're going to do it for somebody who's presumably on a climate change committee.
Right, like the new one that AOC is trying to set up. The money quote on this is something that Alex Lawson, who's been working on this project, he's a guy with Social Security Works. But he's been working sort of in a sort of freelance capacity on this committee assignment situation. Here's what he said to me. He said, progressives come into Congress wanting to change the world, and new Democrats come into Congress wanting to be on the Ways and Means Committee. Like, they're very targeted in what they know they can do to really influence what gets done in Washington. And progressives come in, a lot of them were civil rights lawyers or worked in law firms. They flock to the Judiciary Committee. Judiciary Committee has 75% of its Democratic membership are members of the Progressive Caucus. Mm. It's almost like everybody hangs with their people. It's easier to get things done on the Judiciary Committee if all of the members, or practically all of them, are progressives. It's easier to get things done on the other committees if a majority of the members are new Dems. And so they almost, it's almost like the Jets and the Sharks. They kind of keep to themselves. And progressives have not really told that story of the importance of these committees, maybe until now. And the problem that they're running into is twofold. So the first problem is what you just described. It's just not sexy to talk about derivatives regulation or overnight repo agreements. It's not what progressive members of Congress sort of feel that they came into Congress to do necessarily. And so it's hard to get new members excited about being on these committees. And so the only other reserve there are existing members and getting them to shift committees so that you can get to this 40% level. And that becomes hard because of the seniority factor. So if you spent 10 years on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and you're seeing this incoming Congress and the sort of remote but possibility of an infrastructure bill coming in, why would you want to switch off that committee to start over, essentially, on the Ways and Means Committee, where you don't have seniority and you don't have as much ability to affect the ultimate outcome as you would as a somewhat senior member on a different committee? So you get into that, and then there are other sort of, you know, political factors. Regional diversity plays a role in this. They don't want multiple members from the same state or the same region on one committee. You need sort of a sponsor within the committee if you want to switch or join it to sort of be your guide to make sure you can get onto it and get past the chairman or chairwoman.
Let's just talk about that for 1 second. The sponsor, just tease that out for us, because it seems to me that you've got a problem if there is a, well, I mean, guess presumably, right, there's a member of the Progressive Caucus on all of these committee who
oh,
could
yes.
theoretically be the sponsor.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the question is what influence they have, like, you know, what is their relationship with the chair of that committee? And how does this all end up working out? It's like a Tetris situation to slot all these people in the right place, like a giant seating chart for your wedding. But tons of people can't sit next to each other. How do you do it? And how aggressive are those existing members going to be in helping get new members on? Now, we know that the new Democrats do this as a matter of routine. We learned in the course of our reporting that Josh Gottheimer, who's a second term Democrat centrist member of the Problem Solvers Caucus.
I was going to ask you about them.
I think he's the co-chair of it, actually. That Gottheimer is being that sponsor. He's actually going out and recruiting people to be on the Financial Services Committee. Financial services sector did yeoman work in spending money to get him elected in 2016. He beat Scott Garrett out in New Jersey, who was a pretty right wing guy. But Gottheimer has voted pretty reliably with the financial services sector throughout his first term, and going into his second term, he's trying to get more people who think like him onto the committee. So you have, in addition to what the Progressive Caucus is trying to do, the new Democrats are doing what they always do, which is try to maximize their power on these money committees to really influence the inside of legislation.
And so how is it going? I mean, first of all, who cut the deal with Pelosi? I mean,
that's Pocan and Jayapal had the meeting where they agreed to increase the membership of the Progressive Caucus on these committees. But it's almost like, you know, once they say that they have a handshake deal, you got to bring the horses now. You got to close that deal. You have to find the members willing to switch or find the new members willing to go on these committees and submit them to the leadership. There's a whole process by which committee assignments get doled out. It's the steering and policy committee, which it really is just the speaker. I mean, Pelosi is the chair of the steering and policy committee. And when you're talking about the intelligence committee, Pelosi actually doesn't even go through that. She appoints members herself. So it's really about bringing that package over to the leadership and saying, this is who we have willing to do it. And it's kind of mixed right now. There's a lot of hemming and hawing. It's very fluid. I've heard stories of members saying that they would switch and then changing their minds within a 24-hour period. It's extremely fluid, and it's difficult because it's just not historically what the Progressive Caucus has been focused on, and certainly not what progressives on the outside have been focused on. Committee assignments is not something that has historically been a rallying cry from progressives nationwide. And it's a difficult thing because it's an inside kind of deal. It's hard to influence. But, you know, I was hoping to at least shed some more light on the process and show that, you know, it's not enough just to get elected. There has to be a willingness to govern on the part of liberals and progressives in Congress. And this is right at the heart of that.
There has to be, I guess, on some measure, some level of sacrifice of, you know,
yeah.
I just remember in college, I had a government professor, and I don't know if I should say too much because he was always worried about it, but it was years and years ago. He was sort of, I think, conservative leaning. As a young man, he had served as an attorney for as part of the Peace Corps for. I cannot remember what country it was, but somewhere perhaps in Indonesia, and he stopped the U.S. government from doing weapons testing in or around this country.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, I was talking to him about where I was thinking about going to law school, and I was saying something like Antioch or something like that at the time, and he goes, look, you know, you can go to a school like that, but the bottom line is if you're going to go in and actually help the clients that you want to help, you've got to learn the less sexy things and go in
right.
and actually, you know, play the game as it is so that you can win it for,
right.
you know, have the causes. And that's basically what this dynamic is. Go in,
yeah.
do the less sexy stuff on these committees where it's also going to make your job a little bit harder to raise money. Theoretically, you're not going to go to the town
yeah.
hall, nobody goes to the town hall and says, I'm on the financial services, committee or,
right.
You know, I'm on the energy and commerce committee, vote for me. I'll, you know, impact real change. I mean, voters just don't necessarily know about this.
They don't connect it, but we've been here before in our history. Like, so do you remember the book, The Liberal Hour? Which talked about policymaking in the Kennedy and Johnson eras. One of the huge sticking points was the Rules Committee. So the Rules Committee, which sets the terms for debate and what gets onto the floor and how it gets administered, was run at that time by a segregationist. So there was like no way to get civil rights legislation through. And also it was very difficult to get social policy legislation through because of the fears that if you pass Medicare, then African Americans might actually get better health care too. So, I mean, it was a serious problem. And what they eventually did is they expanded the number of people on the Rules Committee through rulemaking, and that allowed that segregationist who ran the committee to be outvoted. Routinely. So that was the key that unlocked all kinds of great society legislation in the 1960s. And so here we are again where progressives have to figure out a way to get influence in Washington. And it means being, as you said, taking that sacrifice, which it really is, if you're an existing member. To be on one of these committees, yeah.
How do constituents, because you're basically giving up all your seniority. I mean, everything, you know, right. that's a big currency in Congress.
It's huge.
And not just in terms of self-esteem, but literally, you know, you get on a committee because you think you're going to deliver for your district, and you build that seniority so you can continue to deliver material benefits for your district. And when you can't do that anymore, it becomes somewhat problematic. I mean, on some level, there is a quality of in Democratic politics where we're seeing a more nationalization on some level, right? Like things like right. Medicare for all the Democrats, not all, a huge percentage of the Democrats, maybe 50 some odd percent, maybe more, ran on that, that one right. proposal, which is pretty unique as far as I can recall, at least in modern times with the Democrats running. You know, maybe it was against the war in 2006, you know, but this is for in terms of a policy, it's rare to see, you know, the sort of organic nationalization of particularly in midterms. All right. So
and it's difficult to think about. I mean, it's difficult to really project because you can even go more into the weeds here and talk about subcommittees. So like Ro Khanna and Bernie Sanders last week put out this legislation that would force compulsory licensing of prescription drugs if the price point in the United States is larger than a basket of prices for prescription drugs around the world in five different industrialized countries. So that's great. But the head of the subcommittee on health could very well be this woman named Anna Eshoo, who's based in the Silicon Valley area, who is an avowed supporter of the pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical industries. She would never let that legislation come before her subcommittee. It just would not happen. So it's one thing to write a bill, but it's quite another to make sure that bill has a chance at becoming law. And it's hard to sort of get your head around that stuff, but that's the way, if you're thinking toward the future and you're thinking about actually getting action accomplished, that's the way you have to start to think about Congress.
So how is like Pocan and Jayapal,
how are they
executing this? I mean, it's sort of almost like a prisoner's dilemma in some level.
It's about one-on-one talks with members, both from the Progressive Caucus leadership themselves, and also from outside groups. We're talking about progressive groups, labor groups, various advocates, whether it's in healthcare or financial services or what have you, talking to members, saying, we know this is a sacrifice. We know this is hard. We will have your back. We will. And also it's just sort of talking to people on these committees and trying to get them involved and making it sort of a bigger ask. Saying, you know, if your legislation on drug prices can be passed, then you're going to need people willing to vote for it. So you're going to have to do your job to get people onto this committee. So it's very complex, it's very fragile, but it's all relationships and communication at this point to try to get people to do it.
And so, what do we do? Like, I mean, you know, people who hear this story, I mean, how do we influence this? I mean, I guess the only thing that comes to mind right now, and maybe this is just my own lack of imagination, is, you know, Act Blue, funds,
right.
Like, you know, not unlike the Susan Collins one, right? Like that are not
right.
earmarked to
here's
a person.
Here's some money for you if you go onto the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah, here's right. the Ways and Means Committee fund. Anybody who goes on Ways and Means Committee jumps will get a portion of this fund. Here's the one for financial
right.
services. I mean, is that...
Well, I don't know that those discussions are being had, but I, you know, you can certainly do that yourself with your giant audience here. But I think the one way to, for the outside to affect this, you know, it's very hard because it really is an inside deal, is just by publicizing it. So the fact that it's out there now that progressives are having, you know, these difficulties mustering the 40%, that gives a little more leverage to the caucus leadership to say, look, we can't make this deal with Pelosi and then not deliver.
Right.
Like that would be the end of us. It creates a lot more pressure around it to know that yes, this is what's going on, and yes, there is some difficulty. And if you're listening and you have a lawmaker who represents you that is a member of the Progressive Caucus, go check out what committees they're on. And if they're not on the committees that I've just described, the money committees, Ways and Means, Appropriations, Energy and Commerce, Financial Services, give them a call and say, I would really like it if you got on these committees that are at the core of progressive policy over not just the next Congress, but Congresses to come. And the same thing for incoming members who probably haven't named the committee yet. But if you voted for someone who you think who ran on saying they were going to be a member of the Progressive Caucus, they were going to be a progressive legislator, you know, call them and say, what committee are you going on? Here's what I want out of that. There's some room for the outside.
I will say this, that if every office that you just talked about in that universe got 10 phone calls about the committee assignments, that would be
right.
That would represent such an incredible increase. In,
that would be 10 more than they've ever gotten before.
Yeah, and honestly, the way the algorithms work, they're the, you know, 10 phone calls represents an enormous number of their percentage
right.
of their constituents.
It's a lot, and yeah, I think that you know, I haven't seen a coordinated campaign around that, but you know, from an uncoordinated perspective, that should definitely be part of this. That there should be a lot of pressure on these lawmakers to make sure that the caucus, the House Democrats, are represented on these important committees in a way commensurate with the beliefs of the caucus.
All right, let me just lay this out one more time, and I got one more question to ask you about the Problem Solvers Caucus. But so people should understand, you're in a district. You look and you see what your congressperson is serving on. They're not on one of these committees. All you need to do is literally tell four friends, I want you to call this number over the next 3 days and say, I want you to get on one of these committees. It's really important so that you can fulfill the deal. You're going to have a material impact in a way that is so outsized because of this. So people have something to do here. And you can do it. It'll be super easy, and your return on investment could possibly be huge. All right.
You can do it, and I would say you need to do it really quick because this thing is going to be wrapped up by the end of the lame duck session in a few weeks.
All right, so folks, get on that.
You need to do it if you do it.
All right, so let me just ask you, you mentioned the Problem Solvers. The Problem Solvers are a so-called bipartisan caucus of, I don't know, 20 members, 30 members.
Something like that.
They are basically kick the can, pay down the debt. What are those guys called? I can't remember now. Pete Peterson. What's the no labels? And
no labels.
No
they're,
labels.
They're funded instance, by no labels guys.
And then in this instance, they have a label. It's Problem Solvers, but that's okay. It's not really a label. And so these Problem Solvers, they basically went to Nancy Pelosi. You will not get our votes again. The threshold, I think Nancy Pelosi can afford to have about 15 people in the
right.
House. Maybe it's 16. I don't know the exact numbers. Not vote for her, Democrats, before she has to rely on Republican votes to become Speaker of the House. And then things get a little bit complicated. These
right.
Problem Solvers are trying to leverage it, just like the Progressive Caucus did for these committee seats. They have asked for essentially rules changes that are extremely weedy, it seems to me, about how laws get made, who has an opportunity to mark them up, and what processes. Broadly speaking, what is the gist of this? I read those, and I just don't have the expertise to say, hey, this I can see what they're doing here.
I haven't followed it totally closely because this kind of developed over the holiday and I wasn't really available.
How dare
you? I know. But my understanding is that the big ask that they're making is that anything that has some sort of bipartisan agreements, any amendments, needs to get a vote on the floor as part of legislation. Now, I don't know if that amendment has to be germane to the legislation. If there's some bipartisan deficit reduction thing, can it be? Does it have to go into a parks bill? I don't know. But there's a mechanism by which amendments, bipartisan amendments in particular, would get votes on the floor of Congress, really subverting the committee process, by the way. Going around that and moving it forward. So, this is something that you could obviously, see as not befitting the will of the majority of the caucus sometimes. It's kind of puzzling, where what it would ultimately mean. But it's a way to get, conservative, democratic, or moderate, or whatever you want to call it, priorities at the forefront of legislation in the next term, whether or not it has support from the entire caucus. Now, I could see both sides having a problem with this, with Democratic leadership and Republican leadership. Republican leadership doesn't necessarily want these kind of ideas that don't have full support within their own caucus, getting these votes. It's they're as ideologically rigid as anybody. I can see a lot of people having a problem with this. And Pelosi is she's in a tough spot. She, as you said, needs pretty much everybody, on the Democratic side to support her. And so she's got to make these deals. Now, she's been pretty skillful, I would say. And as a last resort, what she could do with this Problem Solvers Caucus is say, all right, go ahead. You're going to vote against me? You really want to do that? You're going to risk a primary in your district because you didn't support the Democrat for speaker, and you set up a process whereby a Republican is the Speaker of the House after Democrats won the majority? You really want to do that? Go ahead. We've already seen the letter that was signed, I guess, by 16 members saying right. They wouldn't support Pelosi on the floor. We've already seen that, two people, Brian Higgins and Stephen Lynch, already sort of waver and say, yeah, I'll probably support her on the floor. There could be a bluff called if there's not a way to resolve the situation. Generally speaking, Democrat or any kind of leadership in the House doesn't want a situation where amendments that are sort of beyond their control end up getting votes. There's a lot to be said for an open process and let the sort of will of the majority work its way. But typically, leadership thinks about the next election and thinks about the hard votes that their members have to take. So, we'll see what happens. But I think Pelosi has played this generally pretty well. Most people know she's going to be speaker, and I don't know that this is a credible threat.
I guess we'll see. David Dayan, fascinating stuff. People can read about what we've talked about in your piece at The Intercept from the 21st. We will put a link to it at majority.fm and in our podcast, YouTube descriptions, all that. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Oh, wait, what's your new book? When's that coming out?
Oh, I don't know exactly a date when it's coming out, but I am going to do something on Monopoly and the impact of corporate concentration on everyday life and everyday people. So a lot of books have come out recently.
Were you going to sell it on Amazon? In... Good luck, buddy.
Pal's Books, man. A lot of books have come out about sort of the aggregate statistics and antitrust policy and things. This is going to be more a book about how people are affected on a daily basis. So.
Looking forward to it. David All Dan, right. Always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Bye.
Bye. David Dan, I would pre-order that book right now, but I don't think it's even available for pre-order. I don't even started writing it yet.
If he hasn't started writing it yet, a couple weeks he'll be done.
The way that guy is
a machine.
He's a machine. It's unbelievable. I still don't understand it. I've known him for 25 years, I guess. But I've known him as a reporter for 15. I still have no idea. I still think there's something going on. If somebody came to me
and
said...
He has like a brilliant group of policy analysts in India.
If somebody came to me like he's in deep cover, you know, like,
he's
oh,
got a
yeah.
team
like
in
we have
Jaipur.
A whole, exactly. No, he doesn't do any of this stuff. There's a whole team of people who do it. They write it for him.
David Dane isn't a person. It's a concept.
Right. And it was revealed or some type of like experiment.
It's all like a stock image photo.
Yeah, exactly. There's like three different people we interview whenever we have David Dayan on. We don't know which one it is, but they all do that voice.
It ends, yeah. In the horror movie, you're in some labyrinth and she's like, hey, Sam, just did a new piece.
Right, there's 20 of them. Maybe he's cloned. I don't know. It's very strange.
Amazon's exploiting a loophole that was signed during the Clinton
he
era.
There was a little bit of a hint during when I asked him how Thanksgiving was. Mm. He sort of answered as if... who really didn't exist would answer.
Right.
He answered it like someone who had Thanksgiving with a bunch of identical David Dayans.
Exactly. Right. All my clones got along.
It was very reinforcing, Sam. Right.
Folks, this program exists because of your support. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. But more importantly than joining the Majority Report today is look up. You got to do, it's basically three steps. First one, I guess, is get on your computer. Second one is look up what committees your congressperson is on. Second and a half step is to see if they are on the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, the Financial Services Committee, or the Appropriations Committee. If they're not on one of those four committees, call them. I guess there's five steps. Call them, tell them you want them to be on one of those committees. They can choose, be part of the deal that the Progressive Caucus has pushed. Obviously, they got to be a member of the Progressive Caucus. And then, once you've done that, write it up in an email, those four steps. I guess maybe we should be a little more clear on it. But and then send it to four of your friends. Have them do the exact same thing, although they won't have to look anything up. They could just call. And say, I want you to be on one of these committees. And believe me, this will have a material impact. Such a small thing, and you could actually make this happen because they get no calls like this. And the idea of four people or 10 people or five people calling because they've read this article, let's say, or heard it on the Majority Report, and they're now keyed into it. This is what moves them. This is the algorithm. I mean, in calling today as opposed to emailing has even more weight. I was an intern in 1986 on the Ways and Means Committee. Brian Donnelly sat on that committee when they were doing the omnibus. And like for every letter you would get or call, there was an algorithm, and it was worth, like, literally thousands of people in the district. All right. So, and then after you do that, then become a member of the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, reminder, we are now, what's the number, Brendan?
Number it, which one?
The what number you think I'm talking about? Are there multiple numbers? How many how many people have bought tickets, or how many tickets are left? Like, what percentage of tickets are left for the Brooklyn Podfest live majority report? It's on January 13th.
Is that dropping like a sack of potatoes. It is low.
Well, I don't know. I don't even know how to contextualize what you just said.
If you don't have a ticket, you got to buy a ticket.
What? Where are we at? 50% now?
Yeah.
Okay. So 50% sell out that we announced a week ago. It's happening quickly. So January 13th, 18 and over, and $15. Get your ticket now because it's going to go away. And then all you'll be able to do is go to Michael's show in February. Now, if you do both,
you're going to have an amazing time.
You're going to be, maybe if we get enough people to do both, maybe we'll just do one in March and we'll just keep doing it every month.
It's actually probably
become
not
the Grateful Dead of podcasts.
It's probably not a bad idea. The Grateful Dead. Get your tickets February 1st. Bell House. Those are also, what did you say? A sack of potatoes. Sure.
Falling like a sack of potatoes.
Those are falling like a sack of potatoes, folks. We'll
hot cakes is maybe a better metaphor.
Hot cakes. Hot latkes.
Really? Really?
With Alona, Bhaskar, Sunkara, and Trevor Beaulieu. It's going to be a lot of fun. And, of course, David, Matt, and myself. Tomorrow on TMBS, Professor Richard Wolf is joining us in studio. For those who are close followers of TMBS, there could be some real fireworks between him and David Griscom. It could get a little ugly. And of course, we're going to be talking about Brexit and what post-capitalism can actually look like. And there's going to be a little bit of a primer on Northern Ireland and the Brexit negotiations tomorrow, 7 o'clock on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel.
Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover still got the Hope Leslie episodes and the Pequot War stuff, which I went on to a friend of the show, Isha's podcast, Historically.
Nice.
To talk about those episodes for Thanksgiving. Also coming up in the next couple of weeks, me and my friend Chris are going to be talking about Democracy in Chains. I'm going to get into whether or not that's historical fiction, as a lot of libertarian economists saying, or am I going to decode some of the rhetorical sleights of hand they used to create that impression on Google?
I'm very excited to listen to that.
Doing a lot of research on this, so that's coming up.
Democracy, I'm interested in finding that out.
Such a good book.
There's been a lot of controversy, and some people I respect think that there were some citations that were problematic.
Yeah, I think.
Not citations, but some leaps of logic around what's his face and whether he actually
Buchanan.
Buchanan was actually, exactly.
That sort of stuff, yeah.
So, oh, I do want to say I was on Ronald Reagan's podcast, and I just want to say that as an example to say everybody really should subscribe to that podcast, particularly with what's happening now. Like, that is a legit everything you need to know on a policy legal level on immigration. We had a really fun time. We talked about Hillary's comments and broader politics around immigration in Europe and the United States, but his podcast is a weekly listen for me, so please go to Redirect.
I'm a bit behind, but it's not just Reagan. He's got at least one other guy.
Yeah, this guy, Matthew Archambault, who is an immigration attorney in Philly, and they are both like in the thick of it, and they have a big network, and it's a really good show.
Folks, Calm and Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged, so you can sleep better, feel great, and stress less. The Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. And right now, just for our listeners, you can go to calmandcomfortblanket.com, use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's calmandcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY, because you cannot put a price on a great night's sleep.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are.